Hello, everybody, and welcome to the GMS Magazine podcast. This is the new season. Yes, yes, we have a new season coming up with a new co-host, which I am extremely excited to have around because, believe it or not, my friends, we are recording on the 9th of September, or September 9th, depending where you are in the world, 2020. And despite the fact that Sean and I have known each other for a number of years in Facebook, I think, Sean, this is the first time I actually see your face. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. I think that's true. usually most people know me as like a screen name or something. How long have we known each other? Like 5 years? Or did they finally see my face?
I think so. Thereabouts. I mean, we've known each other for a long, long time. And, you know, I thought when I wanted to do this new season for the podcast, I've always wanted to have somebody else. In fact, I've always done the podcast with a co-host. And I was very, very, you know, thinking about what to do, who to get. And I thought, you know what, Sean is one of the very few people who has what it takes to actually call on my bullshit and tell me bang on when I'm messing up. And I thought, I need a co-host like that. this is it. She's the one.
I generally try to stay in my lane when I do that, but
I know, but you do it. At least you do it, which is brilliant because you also know your stuff about role playing games, and we have discussed an awful lot of times topics of, you know, ethnicity and culture in games and sexuality and politics and gender. And all sorts of things. And you are on the mark a lot more often than I am.
Oh, well, thank you. it comes with experience. Lived experience a lot of times. It's like, so you kind of see the certain arguments coming. So it's like, unfortunately, certain kinds of arguments are kind of old hat in the RPG community. So it's like,
it turns out. But anyway, I mean, let's talk a little bit about you for the listeners. What's your background in RPGs? Well, I mean, why are you here? Apart from the fact that I asked you to be here.
Oh, right. I've always been interested in, like, I've always been a dreamer. You know, my head's always been in the clouds ever since I was a kid. And I, like a lot of nerds, especially nerds of a certain age, I was into this kind of fantasy and stuff like that before it was cool. So, you know, I always had kind of problems making friends because I didn't have a lot of people sharing my interests. And especially like in middle and high school, I also grew up in a fairly racist area. That didn't help.
I bet.
I'm a Richmond, Virginia native. Born here, grew up here. My parents had the same house for over 40 years, so I have very strong roots here. And when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, it's like, it wasn't as, how you say, it's like now it's kind of progressive here and it's a lot safer to have the identities that I do. But when I was growing up, it was definitely not the case. So it was rough for me to make friends because it was hard for me to find people who were into the same things I was, and I was always a bit of an odd duck anyway. But that interest in fantasy and whatnot didn't go away. I just kind of kept it going, and then I didn't really get a chance to start role playing in earnest until college, or when I went to college in Florida, and that's when I fell in with a D&D group, and then I found a LARP group. And I sort of discovered LARPing wasn't for me. And then from there, it's like I've just been looking. When the indie RPG forums were really active, this is like before like social media proper. It was like back in 2003, 2004, I was active on those. And then So it kind of snowballed, and it's sort of like I just kind of went, I gravitated to the places that were doing the things I was interested in. And so that's how I also got exposed to a lot of indie games, a lot of more narrativist stuff, like things beyond D&D and GURPS, which were beyond D&D, GURPS, and World of Darkness, which were like the big three. So, yeah.
So you've been at it for a very, very long time. Now, why do you favor... why do you favor indie, if that's a word I just invented, indie, and more narrativistic games than D&D or Vampire?
Well, for me, the enjoyment of the role-playing comes from the story and the characters, not really the tactical stuff.
Right.
I mean, people like that, and they can like enjoy that part, more power to them. I'm not judging anybody. But for me, the enjoyment comes from putting characters in situations and forcing them to make choices that mean something. So it's not just a choice between do you want the plus one sword or the plus one battle axe? It's like, well, okay, are you going to choose romantic love or civic duty? That's a much, a much weightier choice. So, yeah. I think those are the things I really like. So that's why I gravitate to things like Primetime Adventures. There were older iterations of them in the indie RPG. And those small free games I keep finding everywhere too. So, yeah.
Okay, right. This is not going to be, this is for the listeners' information, this is not going to be an interview sort of podcast because, we're meant to be chatting about stuff that we like and stuff that we're doing. But I thought I wanted to start, when I proposed to you the schedule, I wanted to start with something that's meaty, because I feel that there is an awful lot of people at the moment making an awful lot of noise on the internet about D&D. You know, it's certainly has become by a mile the most powerful edition of Dungeons and Dragons that has ever existed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's making Wizards of the Coast the most powerful RPG developer and publisher that has ever existed.
Right.
Which I don't feel would be an issue, and I'm not even using the word problem, I don't feel it would be an issue, but there is a massive distance between Wizards of the Coast and the next biggest company,
right,
which would probably be Paizo or Chaosium, one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a friend of mine told me recently that a good tide raises all boats. Is that true?
I mean, I guess it depends on what you're talking about.
Dungeons and Dragons is cool now. You know, it's cool to be into D&D. It's cool to watch this Twitch and YouTube series with Dicebreaker and Matt Mercer and that sort of people going around, and the question is whether the stigma that became associated with role-playing games is going away, and I'm not entirely sure that it is.
Me either. I think role-playing has always been a bit of a niche hobby. And it's, how shall I say this? It's nerdy enough that, like, pretending to be elves and wizards and stuff will ever be truly mainstream in the way that, say, superhero movies are mainstream.
Right.
Right now there's so many places to go to play D&D. They even have like organized play and it's super popular. So on the one hand, it's sort of like, yes, more D&D probably means more people might want to look for things outside of D&D, but at the same time, no one really held my hand to look for the indie stuff either. It's sort of like I might have found one book at my local gaming store and realize that there were other possibilities, or saw someone's house rule set and then found like an actual game product that wasn't someone's house rules, but was very different from what I was exposed to. So I don't know. I mean, I'd like to believe that D&D's popularity raises the profile of other role-playing games. But at the same time, it's like, well, people, despite the coronavirus, I mean, people's time is limited, and it's, you know, it takes time to learn how to play a new game. Mm-hmm. And people don't always have the, you know, and sometimes it's not something you just pick up and play in half an hour, or something that you can learn as you go, like a video game or something. And video games are kind of catching up as far as the role-playing experience. So it's like, well, if you can't, you know, if you're going to charge the same amount of money, like if, say, buying a new RPG book is $50 and a new video game is $50, and you get a similar experience out of both, but the video has all the graphics and it's all smooth and somebody wrote the story and everything, it's like, unless you're a super dedicated role player, which I am, it's not much of a choice. As well, but then at the same time, it was like a friend of mine actually asked me about, a body horror game. Like, are there any games out there that do body horror? Or I'm interested in this thing I found. And, how do you find people to play this? And I'm just like, and I couldn't even tell her where to go because of course, Google Plus is no more. Hmm. And on top of that, it's sort of like, so where do you find these small, independent little, so like the ways that like indie gamers found one another, they kind of just splintered off now. And it's like, there's no one place. I said, well, you go to this Facebook group and you'll find indie gamers. Oh yeah, it's sort of like, okay, I don't want to send my friend who's a black woman just like me into a group or a social situation where I'm not sure if she's gonna be catching any flack or having to deal with any shit. And because I hated people did that to me, at least not without fair warning. So it's sort of like, well, I'd like it to be true that D&D lifts all role playing. The D&D tie raises all role-playing ships, but I don't know.
The thing is, I believe that to some degree and at some level it does, but I'm not sure he's raising them in the right way. And I'll explain. And the reason I say this, firstly, even though this is not a straight criticism directed towards Wizards, but the fact is that Wizards is not going to raise any other role-playing game out of the kindness of their heart, you know.
Right.
At the end of the day, they are a company that belong to a corporation, and as such, they are looking after their own interests, which I don't think that anybody can blame them for doing so. So I don't think they're going to go out there to point out at all the games that they think should do well. So the lifting of others has to be done through two different mediums, either because, you know, somebody goes to a local store looking for a D&D game and sees another game on the shelves and think, oh, I'm going to try this other thing, which is less and less likely every day because, you know, COVID, more stores are closing down. Not every store has an awful lot of games going on. Stores tend to store what they sell, and they know that D&D is going to sell. So it's not a very reliable way of doing it. And the other way is to listen about other games through social media. Mm-hmm. The issue I have is that so many times, as I move in Facebook and Twitter, so many times I'm hearing so many people talking so badly about D&D that I look at them and think, I just don't think I want to be close to people who behave like you, regardless of what you're talking about. So I'm not entirely sure that it's actually working to spread the word of role-playing games. I'm not sure it's doing it in the right way to attract newcomers to that area of role-playing games. Does that make sense?
Yeah. how do I put this gently?
No, don't.
Nerd cultures always have issues like that, where, like, and I think a lot of it has to do with, like, how so many of us are American, and a lot of America's subcultures are so oriented toward what you consume, that you know, it's sort of like everything becomes this, you know, because people like fixate on what they consume and build an identity around it. It can be hard to penetrate out in that way. And it can be very off-putting unless you're either kind of stubborn or determined, which I was at the time. But nowadays, I might not. It was like, I ain't got time for this. But but at the time, I was either desperate enough or just had enough energy and just pure refusal to say I give up. it's just like there's a lot of, how do I say this, a lot of miserable people, and they become the, and it's unfortunately they're loud, and there's and I don't even think that's most people, I just think it's a lot of them, and they're loud, and that doesn't create a welcoming atmosphere, point blank. You know, like, it's just like all the gatekeeping, all that stuff. And especially when you account for gender and race and things like that, it's like, if I never have to hear about the fake geek girl thing ever again in life, it would be too soon. Or, you know, and you know what I'm talking about. The ones where they say, oh, she's just doing this because her boyfriend's into it. I'm like, so what? She's trying something new. Or, you know, it's just like, what difference does it make?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, I heard about the fake girl thing in, I think it was 2013 or 2012, something like that. One of the first UK Games Expo I went to. And I was being interviewed, and the guy asked me, do you know about this thing? I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, this is what happens, you know, and they said, and I just thought, are you being serious? I mean, people actually use that, because it made absolutely zero sense to me that somebody would say, oh, you just don't know enough. You're just doing this because you want to hook up with that guy there. What the hell? What is that?
Yeah.
So, and it still happens.
Yeah. I don't want people to apologize for who they are or feel like they have to, you know, water themselves down or, you know, like, you know, make themselves seem, you know, acceptable to mainstream society. You know, I'm not really into that, but at the same time, you know, you have to be polite. Have some home training. It's just like, you know.
And the thing is it going to affect you? No, shut up. That's it. That it doesn't require anything else. It only requires to keep silent. Is this going to hurt or affect or effect in any way, shape, or form the way that you play around your table? No. Zip it. It's easy. it's very, very easy. So I just don't get, why are people so vocal and so against, you know, D&D? Don't get me wrong. I understand the fear of the monopolization of the hobby and the fear that people will go into role-playing games through D&D, see all the mistakes and all the questionable choices that Wizards of the Coast is making at the time of publishing some of the book, and be put off about it.
Right.
I don't know if calling that sort of thing in the wrong way is useful. fall. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like there's no need for so much vitriol. It really isn't. It's like, you know, anything I don't like, I'm just really to check up, you know, and it seems that other people enjoy it. It's like, you know what? It's not my thing. Or better yet, it's not my thing right now. Like, you know, for someone who loves indie games, I'm actually running a D&D game on a weekly basis. But, you know, it's a game like that really suits my tastes, you know, and I can tailor it to make it fit me and whatnot. And it has a different tone and, a different tone, a different vibe from your average D&D game. But, it is like all in good fun. And I don't know. I don't know where the idea that we're here to have fun got lost. I don't get that.
Well, the thing is, I guess the idea of have fun is very subjective. And I think an awful lot of people feel threatened that they're going to stop having fun if some changes are implemented. You know, the backlash against these options to turn orcs into something else than evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That backlash was absolutely chaotic. I mean, that was just, what the hell is this all about?
Right. It's sort of like when that combat wheelchair option,
Oh my God, yeah.
When that person made that, and they're like, this is just an option for people who use wheelchairs to feel included in D&D. It's like, there's nothing saying that you have to use this. There's nothing saying that every character has to have one of these, or like a completely different rule set where it's like, all the way that you, it's like where it's like another character using this option is gonna completely nerf your character or whatever. And it's like, the people who are against it, I'm like, what? It's not just about you. You know, yes. And it's like, keep growing, grow the fuck up. I just, you know, share your toys with the other kids. It's like, I mean, these are basic kindergarten house training type stuff, like how to get along with other people. And I'm just like, enough already with that.
The thing that I find very funny about that sort of backlash, you know, and how people don't want, you know, oh no, it's a wheelchair, it's not realistic, apart from the whole, you know, fireballs are okay, dragons are fine, but wheelchairs, no. We cannot have wheelchairs, that's terrible. I find the whole concept is a bit, wait a second. They say, I want to play games because I want escapism, and thus I don't want a wheelchair because we have wheelchairs in real life. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, well, what if somebody actually doesn't want the escapism? Mm-hmm. What if they actually want to go out there because they don't feel that their wheelchair is an impairment? It's just something that they use, like you mm-hmm. use shoes, or you know, or you use a chair to sit down, and they want to bring that aspect of themselves, of their life, into mm-hmm. D&D. Why do they have to be left out just because you don't want to see something that other people experience of their lives? You know, hello.
I don't know. It's just, it's like, I don't know why they want to. Why some people want to like shrink the hobby or. Like, I don't get this weirdly obsessive gatekeeping nonsense. It's like, and it's not just D&D either. It's like all through nerd culture. It's this weird, it's like this obsession with not even boundaries per se, but like this like kind of obsession with policing the hobby itself or something where it's like where somebody nominates themselves to be the arbiter of who belongs and who doesn't. And we've seen what happens in real life when you have people who do that. You know, that's how you get people, you know, shooting black kids for being in the wrong neighborhood and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, that mentality never goes anywhere good. And it's kind of like this weird paradox with nerd culture, I think, too. It's like, on the one hand, nerd culture is some of the most diverse, inclusive, people you'll ever meet. And then there's this sort of reactionary side that's really ugly, yet also longstanding, I'll put it that way.
But is it longstanding, though? Because I can also see that happening in an awful lot of people who are just newcomers to the hobby.
Yeah.
You know, so is it longstanding? Because I'm beginning to wonder if this is just an aspect of humans, and this is something that we are seeing more because, A, we're seeing more people coming into role-playing games, partly thanks to D&D, and partly thanks to social media. You know, I think I'm getting the feeling, and this is coming from a completely different country because, you know, I don't live in the US. Mm-hmm. I live in a different country where geekdom is way worse than it is in the US. I mean, I wish I had the level of vitriol in Spain that there is in the United States.
Right.
Because it's way, way gentler and a lot more intellectual. So imagine what I have dealt with in my country.
I don't envy you that. I was like, yeah, it's stuff like that that would keep me out of the hobby, you know. And then it comes in, then there's like those cycles of diversity. Then it's no, we don't want to like change anything. Then it's like the same arguments keep happening all the time. We wonder why. It's like, you know, you kind of push people out. You know, it's the very people who will bring that breath of fresh air to the hobby. And then wonder where they went, or wonder where all the diversity went. And it's like, well, when they were here, you treated them like garbage. So,
well, the thing is, you know, I think the diversity in the role-playing game world is very, very accepted as long as it is invisible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very cool. People say, oh, no, we're so inclusive. We don't mind gay people. We will sit down at the table, you know, we'll sit down anybody around the table. And then you say, hi, can I have a little bit of pink? No, you can't. No, stop showing yourself. Go back. Yeah. This is reality. Go.
Yeah, it's like it's sort of like, you know, like the panic that I think we've seen it a couple of times in the Facebook group. Like, okay, can this NPC have like, can this NPC baker have like this baker, this male baker have a husband? It's like, no,
that's politics. No, that's politics.
And it's like, what?
Why are you making my game political?
Yeah, it's like you're shoving the gay agenda down my throat. That's the one that really gets me. You're shoving the PC nonsense down my throat. I'm like, it's just.
It's horrific. Now, do you think, though, that because this is a conversation an awful lot of people have, you know, Wizards of the Coast, I believe, is doing an awful lot better than they were doing 7-10 years ago. They are not doing perfect, but they're doing a lot better. They have a little bit more sensitivity, even though they still, when they fuck up, oh my God, they fuck up so badly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there, of course. I mean, I think especially now because of like the general political climate, as well as like the Black Lives Matter protests and, you know, the especially in light of George Floyd and the like, and people are being forced to stay at home. Excuse me.
Bless you.
Thank you. People are being forced to stay home and, like, you know, confront this stuff because they can't just turn the channel now. Allergies. Anyway, and so, I guess people are kind of, I don't want to say waking up. I hope this is kind of a sign of things to come as opposed to just a flash in the pan moment. But yeah, it's like, cause people now are kind of like bringing it up without having to be pushed to. And so it's like, and I know it's like, because again, like you said, Wizard of the Coast is a company and they're not going to do anything that hurts their bottom line, you know, in any real way. And I'm pretty sure they're riding the, they're paying attention to what people are paying, what the people are saying and doing, and what they're, what's safe for them to say and do in light of all that. At the same time, it's sort of like, you know, when you look at some of the stuff that they started, like when you look at where D&D started, or where, you know, like now, I mean, I'm not even talking about Wizard of Coast, I mean, TSR, and Gary Gygax, and it's sort of like, okay, just look at the evolution of the drow. It's like,
I would even go a little bit further and take a look into the evolution of the half-orc. You know, I remember when the half-orc was introduced for the first time, and how it was proactively, you know, encouraged that this is the result of a non-consensual relationship. And you look at it now and think, bloody hell. You were encouraging to include rape in your game, and that's about 20 years ago.
It doesn't really feel that long ago. I remember that from third edition. And on top of that, not only were you encouraging put that in a game, it's like, okay, you're actually putting this in front of children. There's that whole savagery thing where they're just dumb brutes, and that ties in, and especially in light of the lack of diversity in the representation of humans, less so in third edition, I'll admit that. They had, what's her name, Ember, and the fighter guy who was more ambiguous, I forgot his name, it was the human fighter guy,
right?
Okay. There was Ember, who was the monk, and she was a black woman. And then there was like the fighter guy that was in like all the art. And then there's a sorcerer guy who I think was Asian, but I'm not certain. But the way that like tapped into some really anti-black, anti-indigenous, you know. And then if you want to really talk about it, kind of even to a smaller extent, like some Yellow Peril type stereotypes, where like, there are whole groups of people who are just born essentially beasts.
Mm-hmm.
And you're encouraged, you know, and it's like, and the game encourages you to not think twice about killing them.
True.
You know, and I'm like, you know, that was some pretty icky territory. And then, you know, and at the time I remember, it's like they stuck by it for a minute. And then now it's sort of like they're kind of reevaluating those choices. And I'm like, okay, good. You're supposed to. Because that's not something I'll be reminded of when I game, you know?
True. And I think the good thing, though, is that I know a few people in Wizards of the Coast, not very many. And I know I hear very good thing about some of the people who are, you know, the WotC at the moment. I hear people speaking very, very, very highly of Ray Wininger, who's running the tabletop scene right now. I hear people speaking very highly of Chris Perkins and Jeremy Crawford. So, to be honest, it's very good to know that one of the lead developers or the lead developer of D&D is also queer, you know, which is, I think, I don't know if it's unheard of, but I don't know if anybody has had that high profile and be openly gay in a D&D development role before.
If they're not straight white men, I'm shocked.
Jeremy, he looks white, so I presume he is. And I know that Chris is, and I know that Ray is. These are the three main people I know. I know that Mike Merrill's definitely. But the fact that Jeremy's been there for a while now, I mean, he's basically developed D&D 5. He's included an awful lot of things that you look at them and think, damn, that's pretty good. And they've done it, you know, in this subtle way, like Paizo's done in the past and like Chaosium's done in the past. And you think, damn, that's good. How How can you give me the womb of the world later on? Mm-hmm. Or whatever they've called that, you know, personification of womanhood, and it's the mother womb or something like that. It was a bit dudes, literally dudes. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking?
Right.
How do they make those mistakes?
I mean, yeah, I think part of it's part of it's who's in the room. I can't lie about that. I think it's like what's happening in like Hollywood now, arts and entertainment, where it's like, you know, for a while minority groups were content with being visible, but now we're realizing that it's not just enough to be visible. We also have to have control over our stories, mm-hmm. you know, control over how we're portrayed to the general public. And for so long, the way that we've been portrayed has been through the lens of people who flat out didn't know what they were talking about. Just put it that way. And we see what happens with that is that you get these glaring mistakes, or you get these tone deaf portrayals sometimes, where it's like, it's tone deaf in some way, or it's just lacking in nuance in some ways, where mm-hmm. You know, regardless of what it is. And it's sort of like the most recent episode of Lovecraft Country I was looking at. Like, they had a two-spirit person on there. That person is not treated well by the narrative, I'll put it that way. And you know, and I was like, and then I just didn't have a good, it ended on a, and then the episode was over. And I was like, wow, and it just left a really bad taste in my mouth.
Okay. And I haven't watched the last episode, so I may not know what you're talking about yet.
The last episode is named A History of Violence. It's episode 4.
No, I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's cringy. Okay. Yeah, and then at the same time, I was like, well, do we really? Because, like, at the same time, why do we expect so much out of, you know, minority media? Why do we expect minority media to be so much better than mainstream media? Why don't we give minority media, you know, the same leeway we give mainstream media? Because, I mean, people have been, you know, making excuses for them for years, and it's like, that's a whole other conversation. But again, it's like, I'm pretty sure that if there was a two-spirit person in that writer's room, or a two-spirit person in that process, aside from the one actor, and I don't even know if that actor identifies as two-spirit, I would assume so, unless I'm told otherwise. I'm not sure it would have been handled the way it was on the show.
Right.
I'll say it that way. And so it's similar to that. It's like, yeah, it's like, I have to say, it's sort of like, yeah, I'm glad people who are not us realize we exist, but at the same time, a lot of our stories and a lot of how we're portrayed are filtered through, like, these lenses that are ours. It's just like, it's like we look at queer media, for instance, and I'm sorry if that word really, trigger warning, I use that word, and I have my reasons for it. You know, so it's like, I'm not trying to say anybody else has to use it. It's just, to me, yes, it's simpler and I'm lazy, but it's also the fact that it has a history that I'm also honoring when I say that. there's, like, you can tell the difference between the things that straight people think is important about the queer experience mm-hmm. and the things that queer people know are important about the queer experience, if you get what I'm saying.
Yes.
And it shows in how queer characters are portrayed, how queer storylines are handled. So, like, consider, I think, She-Ra, for instance. He said, like, you could tell that was not by a straight person trying to imagine what a queer person would be like. Because I feel like if a straight person were handling that, you'd get like the, oh, woe is me. What do I do? How do I come out? It's like it's a certain narrative that you know, the majority culture has in their head. And it shows up in everything they, like, not everything, but it shows up in the things they create. I put it that way. Yeah, that's what I'll say. And I think that's how those mistakes get made too, because it's like everybody has their blind spots. Everybody has like their biases and their presumptions and their assumptions about how people of different identities and different communities actually go about their lives. And for some reason, people are allergic to admitting that and saying, hey, this is not my experience. I mean, I read some stuff and I want to understand it, but it's not my lived reality. So, you know, maybe hire somebody to be a consultant, maybe, you know, bring somebody on the writing team or whatever, because, you know, the mistakes are kind of, aside from being cringy, can potentially be harmful.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's where a company like WOTC has to be very careful. And even though they are raising their awareness, these mistakes, and I'm prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt that these mistakes are happening truly and fully accidentally, you know, that they have absolutely no interest in being sexist or racist or homophobic in their products. That when it happens, is purely out of ignorance and not out of malice or what's the word, or laziness even. Mm-hmm. But I think that they have to get into the idea that they must be even more proactive than they're being at the moment. You know, a few days ago, there was a comment from Sarah, and I can't remember her surname, the woman who designed the combat wheelchair. There was a comment in Twitter from her essentially saying, you know, she's developing the combat wheelchair for an awful lot of games that she cannot talk about because she's under NDA, but it would be great to add it as canon, you know, as official stuff for Dungeons and Dragons and Wizards of the Coast. Mm-hmm. And there were some calls from people to WOTC to hire her as a consultant. Mm-hmm. And the reply from Jeremy Crawford in Twitter was, "We love what you're doing. Please keep doing it." There was a little bit more to it than that, but that was the message. And I thought, wait a second, man. That is the kind of tide that's going to lift all boats. Mm-hmm. You, as Wizards of the Coast, coming and saying to this woman, "What you've done is great. Here, have a few hundred dollars and do some work for us." Mm-hmm. That it is what truly lifts the profiles of everybody, not just Wizards of the Coast, but the role-playing game in general, because it's saying it's not just that we value what you're doing, but if you do something that is worth it, we are going to support it. And that might encourage other people to do something that they may feel is worth supporting, so everybody becomes richer out of it. So I thought the reply from Wizards of the Coast, you know, we see what you're doing, it's great what you're doing, keep doing it. It was a bit, dude, that only benefits you. Mm-hmm. That doesn't benefit anybody else.
Right. Yeah, I see what you say. It's sort of like, it's like all those companies that had that, you know, black square on their social media profiles, like to say Black Lives Matter, and like have no black employees. You know, and it's sort of like, but like, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know, it's like, me personally, it's sort of like, okay, it's like, okay, I'm willing to suspend my cynicism about corporate culture. You know, I'm willing to do that, where it's like, okay, I know you're just doing this because it's popular right now and you can't be seen not doing this, but if you're going to do it, like, at least do it right, you know. Yes. If you're going to do it, don't just, like, you know, do a thing, put a thing on your social media post and say Black Lives Matter. Of course they do. I mean, where have you been? And then it's like, oh yeah, we're going to continue not to look at our, our leadership pipeline. We're going to continue to keep, our Black employees in menial jobs, and the CEOs and the people who are making the money, the C-suite people, the people who are really making all the decisions and all that, those people are still going to be the same white dudes that we've always been. We're not going to change anything. We're just going to say Black Lives Matter. I guess that's better than nothing, but it's like, right now, I think, like I mentioned before, it's like we're kind of getting tired of just being visible. We want, you put your money where your mouth is, really. Literally. Like, invest in the work that people are doing. Invest mm-hmm. in these communities. Invest in these individuals. It's like you have somebody who has a who literally has something you can easily fit into one of your products. It's ready to go. And you're not even going to the negotiating table to be like, okay, what's it going to take for you to allow us to free use of this thing you created? Like any kind of other kind of like creative or intellectual property, if somebody creates something really interesting and unique and Wizards wants to use it, what do? They go to them with their little non-disclosure agreement they come there with their lawyers and stuff and they say, okay, look, you did a great job doing this. Now we want to own it. We want to put our name on it and we want to make it so you can't sue us. And then there's like that negotiation starts opening up. So I don't know. I don't get it. Where it's like, pay the woman.
Exactly.
Pay the woman. It sounds really cool until it's time to actually invest in it or it's time to put real resources behind it. And I'm like, really, people, with the way people are struggling now, it's like, I'm sorry, visibility is no longer enough.
No, that's very true. And the thing is, I understand that we are in a very niche industry, but I
don't think... But this is on the coast.
Exactly. I know that most RPG authors earn very little money. But my goodness, we're talking about a company that's skyrocketing with the amount of money. They make millions. Are you really telling me that you can't afford to pay, to pay Sarah $1,000? Just $1,000to adapt a chair for D&D and make it official, for goodness sake. We're not talking millions to people. We're talking just a few thousands, and that can make quite a difference in people's lives. So I wonder if Wizards is at some point going to be able to get over their corporate influences and be able to react quickly enough, because I know that this is also a certain frustration. It's been frustration from some people who've worked for them in the past, and I don't want to name names. Mm-hmm. But I know people who've worked for them in the past in different roles, and they say it's just that constantly you just bang, bam, bam against a wall of corporativism that doesn't allow you to do anything without going through a massive process of approval that never ends. Mm-hmm. And eventually the project gets turned down and it's a bit, you've wasted 3 months of your life trying to promote this and nothing happens.
Yeah.
So I wonder if they will be able to get over that and be quicker in the implementation of and the resolution of the mistakes they make. That's mm-hmm. I think that's key.
Yeah, it's kind of changing corporate culture is one of those deep work kind of issues, you know what I mean? Like, and this is where I'm going to put my anti-racist organizing hat on. Like, every institution, every organization has different layers to that organization. Where there's there's the one layer, the upper layer, or rather the layer that faces the world, the personnel, like the people who work there. There's a constituency who are the people they're meant to serve. There are the programs and services they offer. And then there's the deeper levels of the organization, which is like how it's structured.
Mm-hmm.
And then deeper than that is the actual mission and culture of the organization. And when you're dealing with an entity like Wizards of the Coast, and you're dealing like, and you're like, the thing you're talking about, it's like, you're not just changing, you're not just shifting things around where people can see it. It's actually some deep reflection that has to go on, because that might mean changing the way things actually work at that company. Hmm. And institutions are built to be resistant to change.
Well, yeah, because they grow to something that benefits them, and change is risk. Mm-hmm. And you know, money is very risk adverse. Money doesn't want to be risked because it can get lost, and money doesn't like to get lost. Like at all. So anyway, let's wrap it up a little bit. So what are the conclusions that we can draw from our conversation? Do you think that the big growth that Wizards of the Coast and thus Dungeons and Dragons is experiencing is going to help other companies or indie, you know, authors and creators?
I don't think Wizards wants their competitors to get too popular. I'll put it that way. I say that a lot, don't I? It's like, I don't think Wizards wants their competitors to get too popular. At the same time, people are going to seek out different role-playing experiences, especially if they enjoy D&D. Or if they enjoy D&D, but this one particular thing is kind of off about it, or if they like a different genre and they want to know if there's a game for it. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's both. No, in the sense of role playing is often being in the hobby, especially as a creator, is very often a labor of love. Even if you work for Wizards of the Coast.
True.
So it's like nobody's trying to get rich or anything. And yet at the same time, Wizards of the Coast is a company that exists to make money. And that means not giving customers to their competitors. And then there's also the aspect where it's like, well, people are going to gravitate, people are going to seek out what appeals to them. And now, of course, with social media and stuff like that, it's much easier to connect with other people that way. Even though, like, the indie scene is kind of fractured a lot. But, I don't think it's automatically one way or the other. I'll put it that way. It's like, I'd like to see that rising tide lift all role-playing boats, but I'm not. I wouldn't rest on it. I wouldn't. If I want to see other role-playing games get prominence, I know for a fact that I will have to draw attention to them. Yeah. I can't rely on Wizards or other big companies to do that work, because it's just not in their interest to do so.
I agree. I think the growth of D&D can definitely help, but it will only do so if we use that growth as a tool to draw attention to something else. Mm-hmm. But if people keep talking about D&D, even if it is negatively, you know, if people keep mm-hmm. talking about D&D to tell other people, don't play this because it's rubbish, mm-hmm. you're not talking about anything else. Mm-hmm. You know, you're still talking about D&D. Mm-hmm. And that's not how things grow. You know, if you hear somebody saying, I play D&D, mm-hmm. I think it's a lot more productive to say, oh, have you also played this? Rather than, oh, why are you playing this? This is shit.
Right. And it's, you know, it's just like any kind of like media, you know what I'm saying? It's like I said, this is a lot of weird, this is a lot of like dynamics of nerd culture. Like, I'm not sure the knitting community has conversations like,
no.
I hear the knitting community is awesome though. So it's like super welcoming and everybody's nice and they kick out the Nazis. So that's a whole other conversation you and I need to have. Because like, why are we so reluctant to kick assholes to the curb? But and it's like, yeah, it's like, people are drawn to people who love things, who are enthusiastic about things. It's like, I've gotten more people to try new things based on my enthusiasm about it than panning something I don't like. I'm like, I've never gotten somebody interested in my horror campaigns because I spend all my time talking shit about D&D.
Okay.
You know, I talk about like, hey, do you like Stranger Things? They're like, yeah, you know, I can make a game like this and I'll be glad to run it if I get X number of people to join me. That's how I got people on board. Mm. It's like, well, this is new and unfamiliar, but you know, I like Sean. She seems into it. It might be fun. Or if it's like, you know, this thing, it's like, or somebody who already played D&D with me and was like, I know you enjoy D&D, but you know, and then this person, I was like, man, I wish I could play D&D, but I don't have time to do blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's such a pain in the ass to prep a game and this, that, and the third. It's like, you know, there are simpler systems out there. And I tell them about them. And it's like, you know, hey, there are much simpler systems out there that's a little bit more user-friendly for the busy adult. I'm like, yeah. So, like, yeah. So, yeah, it's like you get a lot. And I hate using this because I hate using this this saying because people overuse it. But it's like, yeah, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar. Technically, that's not true. But, you know, you draw people in with being positive about things. You draw people in by being like, okay, we get it. You hate D&D, but what do you like to do? I mean, nobody wants to be around a sourpuss all day.
Yes.
Nobody likes that, you know, a person who's nothing but negative about something that other people enjoy that's harmless.
So I agree.
Like, yeah, so it's like, if you want to raise the profile of other role-playing games, do it. Just share your enthusiasm about it. Talk about the awesome things you do with it. Boom.
And you know, I think that is an absolutely beautiful thought to leave this this episode of the podcast, which has been really good fun. I've enjoyed this.
Yeah, me too.
Good. Right, listeners, thank you very much indeed for being there. As always, it's incredibly and truly and genuinely appreciated. Do get in touch. Take a look at the website. Take a look in Twitter, where you can get a hold of me. I am at GMS Magazine. Facebook page is always a good place to get hold of us. And if you want to get in touch through email, by all means, podcast@gmsmagazine.com. And anyway, until the next time, please stay safe. Remember to register to vote and wear your mask. We will talk to you very, very soon.
Put the mask on. Put it on.